Today is September 11, 2013. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lutcher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Legacy Archive, I am interviewing Marty Licori over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Marty, can you begin with when and where you were born and tell me a little bit about where you grew up?
Okay, I was born in Cedar Grove, New Jersey. That's my hometown. And at the time of the 68 Olympics, I had just turned 19 by about a month or two. I think the Olympics were in October, and my birthday was in September, so I was just 19 years old. I had been running at that time for 5 years. I was very precocious and had a very good coach, so I had broken the four-minute mile the year before in 1967 while still in high school. So I believe at the time, and maybe even until today, I was the youngest person to run in the Olympic 1500-meter final. And I say that because my perspective on all this stuff comes from a very young person, and the 68 Olympics were my first time on a U.S. team and my first time out of the country. So anyway, I grew up in New Jersey, and at the time of the Olympics, I just finished my freshman year at Villanova University, which is outside of Philadelphia.
So when you were growing up, how did you first get introduced to track and field? And was track your first sport, or did you play another sport before that?
I really went out for the cross-country team my freshman year in high school just to get in shape for basketball. When I went into high school, I really didn't know what track and field was or cross-country. I'd never done any of it. I had been a baseball player and a bowler, and that's what I had planned to do in high school.
So you joined to get in shape for another sport. What made you want to stick with it, and what was your motivation to excel?
Well, two reasons I stuck with it. Perhaps the biggest one was it was an individual sport, and I had been brought up on team sports, basketball and baseball, which had been somewhat frustrating for me because other people maybe didn't want to train as hard as I did, or there were just a whole different dynamic. So this was the first time I was introduced to an individual sport, and I really liked that I would reap the rewards of my dedication. I didn't realize I would also reap all the pressure of being an individual athlete, which is different than being on a team sport and sharing some of the pressure with other people. And in retrospect, I think if I had been exposed to tennis or some other individual sport, I might have gone after that one also. But by the end of 2 years of being in the sport, it was apparent that I had a talent for it. And so my motivation by my sophomore year shifted from the joy of an individual sport to the possibility of actually being able to get a college scholarship and pay for college by doing this running.
And what was your family's attitude towards sports participation? In other words, were they very encouraging, and did they encourage you to get involved in sports and stay involved, or were they more hands-off?
Well, they were very encouraging, especially after about the middle of my sophomore year when the coach came by my father's gas station and talked to him and told him that I had a talent for this and that I could probably get a college scholarship. At that point, my parents did everything they could to make it possible for me to train as much as was necessary and be devoted to being a runner.
Did you have any siblings or close friends who were also involved in elite sports in high school?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that it was elite. I had one of my best friends was also running track, but at a different high school, and I fell into training with him. Eventually, my brother, Steven, who's 2 years younger than me, also took up running and went to the same high school as I did, and he eventually went to Boston College on a scholarship. So there were two of us in the family that were runners. Mm-hmm.
So you said that your parents pretty much did everything that they could to ensure that you could continue to train and compete. But generally, how would you describe how your training and competition were supported financially and psychologically?
Well, for instance, before I became dedicated to this, let's say I was working in my father's gas station, and that's what I would do during the summer. After that, my father said, well, you don't need to work in the gas station so much. We've got a longer or a bigger prize that we're looking at. And so go down to the Jersey Shore or the beach, which is what we call the shore in New Jersey, and stay with your aunt and uncle, and you can run on the beach, which was, you know, a way to really get strong. So he gave me every opportunity to have the time and the energy to do as much running as possible. And after a summer of doing that, I came back and I was much improved.
Hmm.
Whereas, you know, I would say other kids whose parents maybe weren't as economically advantaged or had to work summer jobs, they fell behind me because I was running more miles a week than they were.
I see. So I want to talk about the Olympic trials and the process there and you know, whether there were any problems or challenges. But leading up to the trials, what were your biggest accomplishments and highlights? I think you already went over that a little bit, but if you want to tell any stories from that period.
Right. Well, I had had a pretty undistinguished freshman year back in 68. Freshmen were not eligible in the NCAA, so I hadn't run very many races. And there was a fellow named Dave Patrick on my team in the 1500 meters at Villanova, who was a favored to do very well in the trials, and I was just kind of an afterthought. So in 68, there was an unusual situation where there were two Olympic trials held, and in the first one, the first 15 or so guys were going to be chosen to go to Lake Tahoe to train at high altitude because we knew that the Olympics were going to be at altitude for the first time. And so I would say my running wasn't doing very well up until that point, but in the first trials, I managed to be in the top 15 and get to go to Tahoe. And my Villanova teammate, Dave Patrick, actually won the first Olympic trials held in Los Angeles and was supposed to have a guaranteed spot on the Olympic team. So now we go to Lake Tahoe, and we're there for a couple of months, and my training is going well. I met a fellow named Pete Peterson who started to coach me because my coach, Jumbo Elliott, was back in Philadelphia. Unbeknownst to me, my coach, Jumbo Elliott, had had a stroke, and that's why he wasn't out there coaching me. So I was working with Pete Peterson, who was consulting with Jumbo, and did a very good job for me. Now, the reason I mention this is one story that never gets told, and it hasn't really got to do with the Olympics, but the Olympic trials. Dave Patrick had won the first trials and was supposed to be on the team. At the trials, a coach from the University of Oregon named Bill Bowerman, who had three athletes competing in that 1,500 meters, manipulated the situation so that there was a vote, and it was decided by the runners themselves in a vote to vote that Dave Patrick's win in the first Olympic trials would be invalidated, and he would have to prove himself in the second trial. So the rules were changed at the urging of Bill Bowerman, who I assumed at the time and didn't know till 30, 40 years later, was not even an Olympic coach. He was just a guy that was there. But he presented himself as if he was an Olympic coach. So Dave Patrick, in the spirit of machismo, I guess, said, yeah, it's okay if you want to throw it out because I think I can make the team again. Well, turned out he didn't make the team. He finished fourth because the coach was coaching him to peak for the Olympic Games and not for the Olympic trials because supposedly he was already on the team. So your question was there anything unusual that happened? Yes, that was very unusual that politics were involved in choosing the 1500. Now, first thing would come to your mind is, well, there should have been a lawsuit. Somebody should have stepped up for Dave Patrick. Well, as I mentioned earlier, our coach had a stroke, so he was in no position to undertake this battle. And so Dave Patrick really ended up getting shafted through the manipulations of Bill Bowerman and the University of Oregon runners, none of whom made the team. So that was a sidelight that was going on at the same time as the Black Power thing, and one of our other teammates, Larry James, was involved in that part as one of the top 400-meter runners.
And this is prior to the Olympic Games that he
Yeah, this all was happening at Lake Tahoe at the training camp.
Well, I definitely want to talk about that and what you know about that. But so how were you selected for the team eventually?
Well, and eventually they had the second trial run, and the first three go to the Olympics, and the first finisher was Jim Ryan. I was second, and another fellow by the name of Tom Von Ruden was third, and then Dave Patrick was fourth. And it just ruined Dave Patrick's life for 30 years. He just never recovered from this dream of his. And he had beaten Jim Ryan, the winner of the trials, earlier that year. So he might have been a contender at the Olympics.
That's a really sad story.
Yeah, and it's a story that very few people... I didn't even really know the whole story until speaking with Dave Patrick, just some within the last 4 or 5 years. It took all these years for all the parts to it to sort of become... for some of us to talk to each other. Like, I didn't know that Bill Bowerman, who came into a meeting and said, do you guys want to take a vote on it, had no authority to do that. I thought he was an Olympic coach. He was an Olympic coach.
Well, how did your friends and family and hometown, people that knew you, how did they react to finding out that you had made the Olympic team?
Well, it was a big deal. Cedar Grove is a little town on the outskirts of Manhattan, but it's in New Jersey. But it's a very small town, and there was a lot of celebration. And when I came back, they had a dinner for me that I think it was about 400 people showed up for. So it was a big deal, and people really reacted well to it.
So now I want to talk about training and preparation for Mexico City and the altitude there, and about training camp at Lake Tahoe. What was your general training regimen, and how did you feel about altitude training?
Well, in 1968, there were still scientists telling us that altitude training didn't benefit you that much at sea level. I think part of the reason that I was able to make the Olympic team is that I adapted to altitude maybe a little better than some other people. Some people react to it better than others, and I reacted to it pretty well. About halfway through the training program, we came down to sea level to Eugene, Oregon, and I ran a workout and I ran a race down there, and I knew something was really happening, that altitude training really was making a difference at sea level. But before that, I would say that runners around the world didn't really know that. We weren't convinced about it. I guess we found it out by accident, by the Olympics being awarded to high altitude. And I would say, I guess that's the one bright spot. The negative of it is I'm 18 or 19 years old, and the fact that the Olympics are awarded to high altitude, I learn at an early age that the people who make the decisions about the Olympics, where they're going to be, how they're going to be, when they're going to be on television, don't have the slightest concern about the athletes. Mm-hmm. That's not what it's about for them. And I say that the day after a former athlete was elected to the IOC, I guess, as its president, which is the first time that a former athlete has been in a position like that. So it took quite a while, but the times have changed.
Mm-hmm.
So true. I'm going into the Olympics knowing that this is a joke. You might as well have had the Olympics on Mars and we were running against Martians. There's no way we're going to beat them. We knew we weren't going to beat the Africans, and that the best runners in the world would just be beaten by lesser runners because of where they were born.
Hmm. Well, tell me a little bit more about the time at Lake Tahoe, any friendships there, and the controversy. You mentioned Larry James earlier.
Well, yeah, it was a tense time. I mean, it was a beautiful place to train, and we were all living on this mountaintop in trailers, but we had unlimited amount of time to train. At night, we would go into the casinos and maybe catch some entertainment or some of the older guys gambling. So that part of it was pretty cool, but at the other side, the black athletes were constantly in meetings and trying to decide what to do over the Black Power movement. Being a young white kid who hadn't formed much of an opinion, I was not a heavy part of that, but we saw the pressure, and I remember Jesse Owens coming to speak to the guys and pretty much being laughed out of the room as not being in touch with the current feelings of race relationships in the United States. And I don't think Harry Edwards ever came to Tahoe himself, but certainly his influence was there. So it's a very tense time for guys, especially after they made the team, to try and decide what they were going to do when they got to Mexico City. But then many of us who weren't black, it seemed like it was just a minor distraction to us.
Mm. While you were there in Tahoe or before, maybe even a couple years before with the Little Olympics, I don't know if you were involved with that, but at any point were you involved in any physiological studies or testings? For example, did you have any blood draws?
At Tahoe, they brought in a doctor who was supposedly going to help us with our breathing technique, and I do think that helped. He was just teaching us how to use our diaphragm better, and I thought that was worthwhile. But as far as drugs and drug testing, I don't remember ever any testing ever going on. I don't remember any studies being done, not with me. Now, Jim Ryan and some of the other guys who maybe were working with Jack Daniels at Alamosa, they may have been doing some studies like that. But in 1968, I certainly never heard of any performance-enhancing drugs or the possibilities for them. And frankly, my attitude was that I didn't want science encroaching on what was kind of an art. I felt I had the best teacher, or the best coach, I should say, and that I was against any intrusion by the scientists.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Jim Ryan several times. What was your relationship with Jim Ryan like in 1968?
Well, you know, Jim Ryan was the golden boy of track, and in 68, I would have run against him. I ran against him when he broke the world record, and I broke 4 minutes for the first time as a high school runner. And I guess I hadn't run against him again, except maybe in the first Olympic trials. And so I was just this, you know, young kid with no reputation, and Jim Ryan was the prime guy. Now, we didn't have much of a relationship because Jim didn't spend a whole lot of time at Tahoe. He was training in Alamosa and Flagstaff and some other places. And there might have been some other things going on that I didn't know about, that I maybe know about 40 years later, that he had had mononucleosis during the winter. So he wasn't one of the people that I remember being there or having meals with all the time. Although I will, you know, tell, I do remember one time that there was a ping pong game going on, and Jim wasn't very good at ping pong. And I thought, wow, he's human. You know, it was like the first time I realized, wait a minute, this guy is not a god. He's just like the rest of us. And silly as it might sound, you know, when you're 18 or 19 years old and you've been brought up in a culture of celebrity and stuff like that, to have the veil stripped away and realize that he's just another, he wasn't a teenager at that time, but that he was just like us, did happen because of being up at the Olympic training camp with him.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of your thoughts of Ryan, back when you really started to become interested in competing in elite middle distance running, did you, aside from your coach, Jumbo Elliott, did you have any other, you know, track heroes or idols that you looked up to and maybe sought to be like them one day?
Well, I wasn't much of a hero worshiper. I was a big fan of Herb Elliott, who was an Australian 1500-meter runner who had won, I believe, Melbourne Olympics. You better check that. Maybe it wasn't Melbourne. Maybe it was Rome. But anyway, his strategy of running, where he had a kick that he started 600 yards from the finish line, was sort of the template that I use. It seemed like we had similar strengths, and I sort of modeled my racing strategy after him, where I couldn't model my strategy after Ryan, who had a really fast kick at the last part of the race, and I wasn't just that fast. Now, but let me digress here a little bit, just two stories about Ryan. First off, I was pretty, I wouldn't say upset, but we felt it was unfair that there was no way that Jim Ryan was going to beat Kip Kano at high altitude. And the scientists were predicting a time that the best time somebody from sea level could run. And Jim, in the end, did run much faster than any scientist would have predicted. But he still lost the race. And what happened after the race stuck with me throughout my career, and I saw it happen to a few other people, so people like Carl Lewis. And what happened was Jim Ryan lost the race. And then many people who are fans of the sports, or they could have been sports writers, whatever, criticized him for losing the race. And they know nothing about the sport, how altitude works, or any of that stuff. And poor Jim had to put up with that, or people coming right up to him and to his face saying, "You let us down." And so I realized, and I set, you know, a kind of a mantra to myself or to other people, that when you're in a sport like running, track and field, well, even whatever sport it is, people who have not lived that sport have not earned the rights to criticize you, and they just don't have the knowledge to make a judgment on whether you are succeeding or failing. So you really have to ignore the public. There's only a small circle of people, your coaches, the other people, like a Jim Ryan today or a Dave Patrick today. If we all got together, there's a bond because we all know how we got to the 4-minute mile or a 3:55 mile. And we know there's only maybe 200 people in the world who understand that. And you can't explain it to somebody who didn't live it for 10 years. So it's just an advice type thing to young athletes that you are in a very esoteric sport, and don't pay any attention to people who are outside of that sport to what they say.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other things I remember with Ryan was I was sitting on the grass with him and Tom Bramuden waiting for the bus to take us to the stadium, and this older guy who seemed kind of crazy started yelling at Jim for shaking hands with people who he was signing autographs and then shaking hands with. And he just seemed like a nutty old man to me. Well, it turned out I found out later that he was Percy Cerruti. And now Percy Cerruti was Herb Elliott's coach, and he was considered one of the great coaches. But what he's yelling and telling Ryan is, look, don't shake hands. When you shake hands, the energy goes from the greater person to the lesser person. You are losing your energy. And he said, with my athletes, like Herb Elliott, I would lock them in a hotel room for 3 days before a race so they wouldn't lose their energy or something. So, I mean, I'm just 19 years old, and I wasn't ready for this metaphysical stuff, which Cerruti. But it was, to me, it was kind of like everybody's got an opinion about what Ryan should do.
That would be hard to be in his skin.
Yeah, yeah.
So was there anyone on the team with whom you were particularly close?
Well, I'll say the other thing. George Young, who I was 19. I guess I was the youngest guy on the team except for a pole vaulter named Casey Carrigan. And George Young, who was probably 35 at the time, was probably the oldest guy on the team, except for maybe Al Orta, who might have been a discus thrower. But so I was roommates with George Young. I'm not sure somebody did that purposely. But he was from Arizona, a quiet guy, and I was from New Jersey, a disallowed New Jersey kid. So it seemed like we were opposites. But what I did learn from just watching him and Ryan was the amount of dedication that they had, which at the time was higher than my level of dedication or my level of work. The one thing that we did discuss that we didn't both see the eye to eye on, they would get up every morning at 6 o'clock and run. And I would get up whenever I get up, could be 10 o'clock, I'd run. And I'd try to say to them, well, explain to me how 7 miles at 6 a.m. is any different than 7 miles at 10 a.m. Because they're like, you need to get up early in the morning and run. And I'm like, well, I don't see where it makes a difference. If you can prove to me, I'll do it. But they're hard work. And I mean, that would be an Olympic thing that you can only get by being on a U.S. team. And back in those days, there weren't a lot of U.S. teams other than the Olympic experience. But that's when you get to observe people with their guard down for maybe weeks at a time. And you see the level of dedication. And I found that out through life. There's a lot of people think so many things come with natural talent, but when you really can observe it, you find out that it really isn't natural talent. It's a lot of work, whether it's music or sports, whatever. It's very hard to conceive how dedicated some people are that get to the top.
Mm. Well, before you arrived in Mexico, or maybe around the time that you arrived, do you remember hearing anything about student protests and violence in Mexico City?
Well, you have to realize that we're in Lake Tahoe, living on a mountain training. And I was also 19 years old. I knew nothing about what was going on in Mexico City and the killing that had happened there. I did notice on the bus from the airport that there were soldiers every 15 yards along the road at one point, and that seems very strange to me. But I truthfully didn't really know. Somebody might have said, well, you know, they had a riot here or something, and that was it. I don't think I knew for 30 years that 300 people had died. It wasn't until afterwards, one of my daughters is a PhD in Latin American studies, and another daughter-in-law is from Latin America. And for these people to, you know, tell me about some of the things that either the United States government has done, or, you know, they opened my eyes to researching some of the things that they had done. But at the time of the Olympics, whether we were shielded on purpose, or, you know, just your average coach would say, don't think about that stuff. It's not your concern. You have to just get ready to run. So, no, I was living in a, you know, a perfect world where everybody was perfect. And, you know, we went to the Olympics in 68, and we went into our rooms, and I don't think there were locks on the doors of the room. So anybody, you know, from any country could come in and go in your room. It was just a, like an Alice in Wonderland type of experience.
Mm. Once in Mexico, did you venture out into the city and interact with any of the citizens there?
I did one time. I think I went outside the Olympic Village and we stuck out our thumb, and a couple of girls picked me and another guy up, and we went into town with them. And I don't think, none of us could speak Spanish, and I don't think they spoke English. But we had a really nice time, and I kind of remember, I think it was the first time I was ever in a compact car. I was just kind of shocked at how small the car was, because I grew up, my father owned a gas station, and we drove around in Cadillacs and Thunderbirds and stuff like that, and I was probably in some kind of a small car for the first time. The people were terrific, but on the other hand, the building that we moved into wasn't finished. You know, here we are arriving for the Olympics and there's no towels. You got to hunt some towels down. There was no security. This is pre-1972. There was no security. So you could open your door on the 10th floor of the dormitory and there'd be a local townsperson, or maybe your mother and father just came to your room. Far cry from the Olympics today.
Definitely. Well, what was the food like, and did you or anyone you know suffer any food or waterborne illnesses?
You know, I just don't remember about that today. I'm sure we might have had some problems, but I'm not usually one to complain about food. I don't really remember any problems with that.
Uh-huh. The opening ceremony, what are your reflections and memories from that period?
Well, I remember that it lasted a long time, and I remembered that when they let the pigeons out, that the people who had been to the Olympics previously all were prepared with a newspaper to put over their head so that when the birds got out of the cages, they didn't poop on you. I don't really have too many memories of it. I was always kind of against nationalism. I didn't buy into the "we're the world's best country" type thing, and so the nationalism part of it was a little scary to me because it seemed reminiscent of something that Hitler might have put on. And I can then in the closing ceremonies, I didn't march in them, but I watched from the stands, and I remember saying, well, this is great. I'm going to train another 4 years for this and hopefully be back. But I guess I wasn't at that time a big fan of the opening and closing ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't a fan of pomp and circumstance because a lot of what that reminded me of was just Nazi Germany.
Yeah. Well, did you have any memorable interactions or experiences with people from other national teams while you were at the Olympic Village or, you know, at the Olympics in general?
Well, there's one I would mention, and I would say no, we didn't really have a lot of them. But I remember somehow we were training on the practice track at about the same time as the Russians, and there was a really cute little sprinter, and I was like looking at her, and she was looking at me, and then you know, a coach would come over and grab her. So it was like we wanted to say something, but it couldn't happen. And then I think the next year, the U.S. and Russia had a meet in Los Angeles, and the same girl's on the team, and I'm still on the team, and I see her. And at one point, some Russian runner comes over to me and says, "Man, you know, nothing's going to happen here. These guys are all KBG. You two guys are not going to get to talk to each other."
Aw, that's a sad story.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's sort of like, you know, everybody has that romantic notion. There were a few people that met at the Olympics and end up getting married from different cultures, but it's far more rare than you would think. Although today it's probably not.
Yeah. I have heard some of those stories. Well, anything that you want to tell me about from the day of your actual event competition? Anything that stands out? I read that you had a stress fracture. How did that happen?
Yeah. Well, it had been a kind of a long season for me, and I was battling this stress fracture, and in one of the preliminary races, it really got bad, and I guess it's 40 years now, but I felt that once it was really bad, I didn't really get good medical care. It seemed like everybody was really concerned about how Jim Ryan's going to do, and I'm like, my foot really hurts. I'm like, okay, well, we'll ice it tomorrow before the race. And that's what we did. We iced it, and it was, you know, that didn't work. In retrospect, I should have gotten a shot of Novocaine or something like that, but I felt like, I think there was maybe one team doctor for the whole team or something. So I didn't, you know, in those days, the medical care wasn't what it would be like today with your team of masseuses and chiropractors. And I guess one of the things that I point out to runners today, because they're all looking at having this long career, and I don't want to burn myself out because I could be doing this for 10 or 15 years. And I said, you know, the mindset for Jim Ryan or myself, here I'm 19 years old, I'm about to do my sophomore year in college, and I'm at the Mexico City Olympics, and I'm really thinking this is my last Olympics, because by the next Olympics, I would have been out of school for 2 years. And in those days, guys didn't continue to run after college. There was just no system. A few guys might have competed on the indoor circuit, but we really thought our careers were linked to college, and when college was over, you would probably, you know, also retire. So I didn't really even totally believe that I'd be around for the next Olympics, whereas today a person goes to the Olympics and says, okay, this is for experience, and the next Olympics or the one after that is when I'll be at the right age and I'll be at my peak. But we really didn't think there was any system for us to continuing running after college. And even my own college track coach would tell me, hey, okay, it's time to get a job. Get a job now. Don't fool with his running stuff. And I didn't listen to him, but things were changing in the 70s.
Well, that brings me to another question or topic I wanted to talk about, and that's amateurism, just your reflections on the state of amateurism as it was when you were competing versus, you know, what it is today.
Yeah. Okay, I got a couple different takes on that, and of course I was against amateurism because of its origins of the elite trying to keep the working class out of the competitions and that kind of stuff, and just that it had to change. And myself and Frank Shorter and some other people played a small part in getting that change in the way that we kept pushing the rules and that kind of stuff. And in the 70s, when I had a chain of sporting goods stores, we were the first corporation to sponsor a corporate track team And that sort of opened it up. And then Frank Shorter helped in a lot of ways with his idea of a trust fund. And in all this time, some of the older people like Avery Brundage, of course, were fighting against amateurism. In his case, it was probably just from the old fashion of keep the lower classes out of it. But in retrospect, well, one of the reasons we really wanted to get rid of amateurism is because we felt we Americans were the amateurs, but the Russians were professionals in that their government supported them. They were on their government team. They had all kinds of supports. And even in Germany, which was a democracy, they had a lot of support. So we were fighting and fighting to get on equal footing. Well, when we finally got rid of amateurism, the unintended consequence of that was that we opened it up to the entire world, and that meant that the Africans and the other impoverished people were able to compete on an equal basis with those of us from the first world countries. And the result is that they now, they being the people coming from poorer backgrounds, dominate the sport. So that was kind of an unintended consequence. We thought we're going to get on equal footing with the Russians and the Scandinavians, never realizing that there was this whole tsunami over here of third world athletes, which when they're given the opportunity, they're going to just kill us. They're willing to work harder. You know, they have masses of poor people from which a sport that depends on hard work is going to do better in a society with a lot of poor people rather than a society where, you know, people are coddled.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, aside from the hard work and the will and drive to escape poverty, I guess it might have also had to do with their geography as well?
You mean the fact that a lot of them come from altitude?
I guess, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's only a small part of them are successful because of the altitude. I think, you know, many of them are successful because that now they're on an equal footing. And the other thing I worry about, that if there was not money involved like there is today, would people be taking drugs and performance-enhancing drugs to succeed? You know, if we were able to magically turn back the clock and make it all amateurism. And I suppose, really, though, it wouldn't matter, because if the drugs are available, there are people who are not competing for money. They're just competing for the glory or maybe even the personal satisfaction that still decide to go down that road and use drugs. So the getting rid of amateurism probably plays a small part in the extended use of drugs, but it would have happened anyway.
Hmm. Well, going back to your competition day, did you suffer the effects of the high altitude?
No, I didn't suffer at all. I responded to it pretty well and was able to compete at it well, even though slower. And when I came back after the Olympics, I was running very well. I felt very strong, and I more or less knew that high altitude was a training tool that should be used. But I chose to move to Florida to train, and when people started, like Frank Shorter, started leaving Florida to train at altitude, I consulted with Dr. Robert Cade, who was the inventor of Gatorade, and seemingly knew a lot about physiology and exercise physiology. And he said, well, Marty, being at altitude is helpful. It changes your red blood cell. He said, but being at high humidity like this increases your blood volume. So you may have just as much of an advantage staying in the heat as you would going to Boulder, Colorado, where it's high altitude, but it's not hot. And in retrospect, he was right in a lot of ways, because the people who train at high altitude now in a high, dry climate, they go to the Olympics, which is held in Seoul, or Barcelona or Sydney, all these places that are hot and humid, they don't run well because of the humidity. And I was always able to run well in very hot conditions because I'm used to it here in Florida.
That makes sense.
Well, it makes sense. A guy from Florida is going to run well in hot and humid conditions. But if you want to set a world record, then you go to altitude and you go somewhere like Sweden where it's very dry and you run a fast time and you get the world record. So, you know, it's all science and it's taken years for people to figure out how all these little tools need to be used correctly to get the benefits out of it.
Yeah. Well, after your race, did you have to do a urinalysis?
I can say I don't remember anything like that. Uh-huh. I don't remember ever being tested for anything.
What about the gender verification testing that was introduced in 1968 for the women? Did you remember hearing anything about that or talking to any of the women about that?
Well, I remember it coming in, and being a male, it wasn't a big thing for me. And back in those days, in the 70s, a male runner would not know a lot of female runners because there were no college scholarships for female runners. So if you were at X college, there was no women's team, okay? And I wouldn't know the top women athletes in the United States because the men's U.S. championships would have been held at a separate place at a separate time than the women's U.S. championships. So the concept that you have today where you go to college and you might meet your lifelong mate who was also a runner, that never happened. I mean, none of the runners in my day would be married to a woman who was an athlete. Whereas today, almost all of the top, collegiate runners end up marrying somebody who also was in the sport. So it's a very different world. I don't know what else to say about it other than the tests were probably necessary because there were, and it's, eventually been proven, there were Russian shot putters and stuff like that who were not women.
Yeah. Were you there when Smith and Carlos protested on the medal stand?
I wasn't there. I didn't see that. No. My memory of it was I came down the elevator and I'm walking out of the door of the dormitory and a bunch of microphones are there and they're like, "Well, what's your opinion?" type of thing. And I'm like, "What are you guys talking about?" So I was kind of oblivious, and I guess the next thing I knew was they'd been told they have to leave the village and all that kind of stuff. So again, it wasn't like it is today, where you have a room with a TV in it, or there's a press room, or there's a sheet going out daily, or you can read the local paper because it's in Spanish. And this happened again to me in 1972. In 1972, when the Munich tragedy happened, I was working for ABC Sports, and I was there through the whole tragedy. But when I came back to the United States, I didn't really know anything about it, and everybody in America did, because they sat transfixed looking at Jim McKay. Well, I was just in a hotel room trying to watch German TV and figure out what the hell was going on. I couldn't see Jim McKay. So again, it wasn't until 30 years later where the Jim McKay stuff begins to be put on YouTube that I actually see why everybody was in such, awe, whatever, of Jim McKay and what a great job he was. But so when you're a participant in this, or maybe it happens in every sport, the people at home sitting on their couch are more informed about things than you as an athlete are.
That is a really interesting effect. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about the media. Was any of your race televised back home to the United States? Did anybody end up seeing you on TV?
Yeah, I did. They did. And I forget what the number of hours of coverage, but I think the number of hours of coverage of the entire Olympics in Mexico might have been 63 hours, whereas, you know, now we're talking about 3,000 hours, whatever. So it was very much different. I'm not sure if it was live, but I do know that my girlfriend at the time was at her college dorm, and everybody was gathered around the TV to watch me race. So, yes, it was back to the United States, but again, I don't think it was that big a deal. For instance, in 1964, the Tokyo Olympics, as I told you earlier, I used to go down to the Jersey beaches and run all summer, where we didn't have any television. So when I made the Olympic team in 1968, I'm 19 years old, I had never even seen an Olympics on TV. I didn't even really know what the Olympics were.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, and contrast to some kid like Mark Spitz told me a story once. You'd have to check this with him because he was in 68, but we were standing together one time, and Peggy Fleming came into the room, and he said, "She's the reason I became an Olympic swimmer." I said, "What are you talking about? You wanted to meet her or something?" He said, "No, I was sitting on the couch with my father watching the Olympics, and my father said, 'You'll never do anything like that.'" And that just lit a fire under Mark Spitz. To prove father wrong, I guess. But, you know, I never had any experience like that. I had never seen the Olympics on television until, well, I guess almost. I never really have seen until the last two Olympics. Never sat in America and watched American television because I didn't watch 64. In 68, I was in them. In 72, I was in Germany working on the show. And then every Olympics after that, I was either doing the commentary for TV or radio. So I never, you know, I can't consider myself an expert. Everybody else who's been back here in the United States watching the Olympics is more of an expert than me, because when they were watching whatever, Nadia Comaneci or all those gymnasts, I was sitting in the track stadium getting ready to do commentary on the next race.
I see.
So it wasn't until China and the last two in London that I actually got to sit there and see what it's like to watch the Olympics from home.
Uh-huh. Well, what was it like to be on the other side, to do the commentary for the track?
Well, for me, you know, you're doing a job, and I literally, let's say if I'm doing the 800 meters and they come off the last turn, and now after they come off the last turn, I'm not supposed to speak anymore. It's up to the other announcer. Then I literally stop watching the race and I start getting ready for the next race, which could be coming up in 3 minutes. And so sometimes I watch 90% of the race and I almost don't watch the finish. If you ask me an hour later who won the 800 meters, I don't know. I don't know, because I was getting ready for the next race. So you handle it a little differently, and it's sort of like, and that would be the thing, if you're at the Olympics and a tragedy happens, or the John Carlos thing is happening, as an athlete, you have to focus on this once-in-a-lifetime chance of yours. You can't get caught up in that controversy because of the energy it takes or the distraction, which, you know, is a shame because everybody is so concerned about their own situation that maybe we weren't helping Tommy and John as much as we should have been at the Olympics. Like, they were cut off by the powers that be, but I don't know how much support they got from their fellow athletes, mm-hmm. who also said, "Hey, I'd like to help you, but I got a race tonight, or I got a race tomorrow morning."
Yeah. Well, did you get to attend any other events? Did you witness any of the record-setting events from the 68 games?
Well, I did walk into the stadium just as Bob Beamon was jumping, and I remember seeing that. But again, being in the stadium, you're like, why are they going crazy? What did he just do? What's the announcer saying? Oh, my, I got to get ready for my race. I do have one story I know about that. We were talking about the Olympic coverage, and the guys from ABC had just gotten into the stadium, and there was something like, well, and I'm not sure if Beamon did this in a preliminary round or if it was the finals, but I know that it was a situation where they said, let's go ahead and tape this anyway. And like they turned the cameras on, and Beamon's historic jump was the first jump they got. I mean, they almost missed it.
Wow, that was really lucky for them.
Yeah.
So what did you do right after your event wrapped up?
Well, probably the most life-changing part of it for me happened after the event. For some reason, I decided I wasn't going to stay around for the next couple of days and go to the Olympics. And I had met some guys that I knew, and they were going to drive from Mexico City to Acapulco in a 1949 Cadillac. And so I went with these guys, and this Cadillac couldn't be turned off because it was turned off. It wouldn't restart. But the part, I guess, that was life-changing to me was stopping for hamburgers by the side of the road and, you know, just seeing bugs that, you know, looked like birds to me. They were so big. And I remember at one point we came to a junction. They said, okay, you can either take this road, which is free, or you can go on this toll road, which is going to be faster. So we came up. I mean, we almost had almost no money, but we came up with the money and we took the toll road. Well, this toll road that we were on for about 7 hours was worse than any other road I'd ever seen in you know, America. So I still would wonder what the bad road would have been like. But on this toll road, there would be dead cows by the side of the road, or people's houses came right up to the side of the road, and you could, you know, see these poor people in there, you know, sitting around the fire eating. And it was, you know, the first time for me to see poor people. So that was more life-changing for me than the actual Olympics.
So once you got to Acapulco, did you guys stay there for a few days? What did you do there?
Yeah, we stayed there for a couple of days, and I remember we were out there swimming, and they were renting surfboards to us, and we're having a lot time of our life. And then somebody said, "Well, you know, there's sharks out there." So, I have to think. I don't know why I didn't stick around to see the Olympics. I guess maybe the pressure and everything. I was so relieved that I just wanted to leave.
Uh-huh.
See, I wanted to see the country, and which, you know, I went on to continue to race internationally for about 10 years, and that's why I did it. I like going to the foreign countries, and it's not just visiting the countries, but you actually, because of the sport, you got to meet people who lived in those countries and discuss their type of government or the problems they have or their taxation systems, and that kept me interested.
Mm. Well, for you personally, what was the most meaningful part of being an Olympian and competing in the 68 Games?
The most meaningful part of being in the 68 Games?
Mm-hmm. Or of being an Olympian, for you personally.
Yeah. I would say it's that you're given a unique opportunity to realize that everybody in the world is just the same. There are no bad Russians. There are no backward people. We're all the same, and the governments just get in the way of the people-to-people communication. And then that's what the Olympics is needed for, to strip all that away for a little while every 4 years to remind people of that. And I think anybody who's been an Olympian just has a different approach to life and what the rest of the world's relationship is to us. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, as you get older, you do meet other people in your events. And maybe not so much in track and field, but these smaller events like fencing, where there may be only 100 competitors, top competitors there. Those people, I think, become closer to each other than, say, somebody in track and field. But, I mean, the bottom line is to realize that the human race looks a little differently, but we all have the same wants, needs, and desires. And just because a person was born in a different place than us doesn't really mean they're any different than us.
Mm-hmm. Very beautifully and eloquently said. What was your homecoming like?
Well, as I said, the people, the town or the few towns around came out and had a dinner for me, and Larry James attended it, and a couple other Olympians. And, you know, they really made a big deal of it. So I suppose for the next generation of athletes who maybe are motivated by that type of thing, they saw what happened to me and decided to work hard to try and do a similar thing themselves.
You spoke a little bit about what happened with Smith and Carlos and the treatment that they received from the Olympic Committee. How do you feel about what they did and the response?
Well, on one hand, I really would have hoped that the Olympics could be kept free of political statements, mainly because once you open that Pandora's box, you don't know where it's going to end. That almost every athlete that gets up there, it's their, you know, 15 minutes of fame, and they're going to try and make a statement, whether they're, you know, Tibetan people that have problems with China, or, you know, South Africans, whatever. So philosophically, I guess before it happened, I would have said, keep it off of the bandstand. But in retrospect, it was a certain time in history, and I think that their timing was right. It needed to be said at that point. It was the lesser of two evils, the other evil being that the black athletes would have not competed at all for the United States, which would have probably been harmful to them, because you can't really ask them to give up their once-in-a-lifetime chance. So I guess in the end, I think it was a brave thing for them to do, and I'm glad it happened.
What impact has being an Olympian had on your life?
Well, I can't really say that there's anything specifically that I can point to that being an Olympian has made a huge difference. And the reason I say that is because my athletic career, being number one in the world and being involved in television and all those things, sort of eclipsed being an Olympian. For some people who maybe being an Olympian or just being on the team was the high point of their career, they might say that it affected their life more than I would say it's affected me. Because if people were to use a word to describe me, I don't think Olympian would, you know, jump right up there. But there are other people where that might be the first thing. So I would say it's been a two-way street. I haven't used my Olympianism. I haven't been that involved in the Olympic movement because I was so involved in broadcasting. So it hasn't been as big a part of my life as I think it has been for some other people who you know, did that Olympic thing. And that's just being honest about it.
I see. What one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
Well, to any athlete or anybody doing something that they're trying to be among the best in the world, you have to first enjoy the process that it takes you to get to the top, because it's going to be very hard. And unless you enjoy the process, then you shouldn't be doing it, because the chances of becoming successful are small, and you don't want to regret all the time you spent on the training. So you need to enjoy what you're doing. You can't do it because I want to become famous or I want to be on a cereal box. You have to do it because I enjoy figure skating and jumping and twirling and sticking a landing or whatever it is. So I guess I would say make sure you're doing it for the right reasons, because you love it, not because of the result you're going to get. If you get the result, that's a bonus.
Mm-hmm. In your opinion, what is the legacy of the 1968 U.S. Olympic team?
Well, I think it was a time when the United States still dominated the Olympics. That's one of the things. I sometimes, you know, wonder why people like Beeman, Segrin, Mattson, all these names from the 68 Olympics are still big names in our sport, whereas people who came after them, who maybe accomplished just as much, are sort of forgotten. And one of my theories is that it was 1968. The Vietnam War was really going on. And I feel people read the paper every day, and they happened to turn back to the sports page, and we were on there. And so in many ways, I think no team since then has gained the notoriety. I mean, there were other things, too. There wasn't the NBA. There wasn't the NFL. They weren't as strong. And so we were maybe the last time where the U.S. Olympic team was the height of U.S. sports, whereas today you might say the NBA is the most popular thing.
Uh-huh.
And it was a time when we had advantages against the rest of the world, just in the amount of protein that we ate in the United States compared to some of the other places in the world. And we dominated. So I don't think, and I don't think it'd be a good thing, but I don't think the United States will ever dominate again the way we did in 1968. So the legacy is how good we were, how good the individuals were, the place that track and field still occupied in the American mindset. But over and above that, that 68 was a time of change, and Tommy and John also They also took that into the world of sports.
That's true. Absolutely. You mentioned a little bit about the USSR and Soviet athletes, and since you just mentioned 68 and you know the geopolitics of that time, did you feel the effects of the Cold War or notice any effects of the Cold War while you were at the Olympic Games?
Yeah, and I just didn't buy into it. I felt it more the next year in 69 in Los Angeles. We had a track meet, the United States versus Soviet Union. And I got a lot of pressure. By that time, in 69, I was number one in the world or on my way to being the number one guy in the world. And I wanted to stay in Europe and compete. And I was getting a lot of pressure to come back to the United States and compete against the Russians because of blah, 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 this Russian. And my thing was, you know, I don't really believe in that stuff. You know, that we've got the world's best country and we've got to prove it through our track team. I just never bought into it. So I was sort of fighting against it.
Well, Marty, you've lived such a fascinating life, and you know, all of your adventures and ventures that you've taken on in life are really interesting to me. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Okay, I'm not sure which angle you're talking about. I mean, I feel that I was very fortunate in that I got to compete in the Olympics and compete at a high level, and then I got to extend that career 25 years or so longer than other people, and that I was part of the sport doing television commentary, which I enjoyed for many years, and was able to meet a lot of outstanding personalities. So I felt, you know, very fortunate to do that, where a lot of my colleagues, you know, a Bob Beamon, really, he set a terrific record and everything, but I don't know that it changed his life that much for the better. And in fact, you know, in Carlos and Smith's case, what happened in 68 changed their lives for the worse. So I've been very fortunate in the way that the sport has worked out for me. I don't know if that's what you were aiming for there.
Sure, yeah, and I've also read, I read about the chain of stores that you opened and ran, and also what you're doing today. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I did start a chain of stores just as a running boom was happening, and stayed with that for about 25 years until we sold it. And on that, I would just say this, that had I come along 40 years later, I probably never would have done that, because I would have been a professional runner. It would have been taking up more of my time. I might have been making a couple $100,000 a year, so why would I want to open up a shoe store selling shoes? But since we were amateurs and all of us had a day job in addition to training for the Olympics, we had more of a normal life than, say, somebody today who might compete until they're 35 and make a pretty good living at it, but then they're 35, and what skill do you have? Well, I'm a triple jumper. So there were some benefits to being an amateur that the professional guys won't have. They might have more money than we did, but they won't have had some of the life experiences that we have. I guess I just was talking about this with someone else on an interview. Today, you know, I'm 64, and I'm basically a jazz guitar player, and I go out and play jazz three or four nights a week in restaurants with different people. I'm not a solo performer. I'm out there with a lot of people, mixing it up, having fun. And I do that because I feel that there's a couple things that I've learned, that a happy person, people measure happiness based on where they've come from to where they are now. So in other words, a person who was born in a hut in Kenya, who now lives in a modest house in the major city there, or a modest house in the United States, is happy because they've advanced in life. Whereas somebody who was born on Park Avenue and now is living in the suburbs of New Jersey might not be happy because they're not living as well as they were when they were a young person. And similar to that, the corollary I come up with is, as you're getting older, you see a lot of your, you know, if you're an athlete, your powers fade by the time you're 30, and you're kind of managing this lessening excitement about life. But if you continue to take up a new sport or a new endeavor, or for me at 50, take up music, then every day you have that process again. Remember I said you have to enjoy the process. So the process of practicing music, even if I never get to play in public or play with other people, all those hours I spent practicing were fun for me. Mm-hmm. So I haven't spent time that I feel is wasted. And so if you take up a new activity that you will, I guess the worse you are at it, the better in the beginning. But if every day you feel like you're progressing, you're becoming a better singer, you're becoming a better musician, you're becoming a better gardener, then to me, you're still getting the things that we got as youths, or even somebody trying to learn to walk. The satisfaction of, oh, I just went 10 feet, oh, I almost fell, but now I'm going 15 feet. That joy of improving in your sport, if you apply it to other lessons in life, as long as you find something that you're bad at and you can continue to improve every day, you're going to be a happy person.
Mm-hmm. I also think it keeps you young.
It keeps you young, yeah. Well, music and all these things tend to keep you young. I'm in a band with one guy, and the one guy's 22 years old, and I'm, you know, 64. So he's telling me stuff that blows my mind, and I tell him stuff that blows his mind. But it's nice that, you know, he's younger than my kids, but you have conversations with colleagues that are different than the types you'd ever have with your kids.
Uh-huh. Well, looking back on all of your accomplishments, what are you most proud of?
One thing I'm proud of that I don't think people even realized happened was I used to run in Madison Square Garden, and there'd never been a 4-minute mile in Madison Square Garden. And at a press conference, I said, well, the reason is the race is at 10 o'clock at night. And by 10 o'clock at night, people have been smoking in the garden for 3 hours, and we really just can't breathe. So the announcer for the event said, all right, here's what I'm going to do, Marty. I'm going to tell people, I'm going to announce every 15 minutes or so that people to not smoke and to go outside under the stands and smoke there, because you're going to attempt a 4-minute mile in the garden. So we did this, and as it turned out, and he did this all night, and by 10 o'clock, the garden was pretty relatively smoke-free, and I changed my tactics, and I tried to break the 4-minute mile. And I ended up losing the race, and the guy named Tony Waldrop passed me. But he did break the 4-minute mile, and it was the first 4-minute mile in the Madison Square Garden. But the thing that happened was, then they started doing that at every track meet. Because you have to remember, even the NBA players, I think, they played at NBA games, and people were sitting there in the stands smoking. It's just hard to believe we ever did that today, but it's just kind of a thing that happened, and I'm proud that I started the move to realizing that athletes shouldn't have to play in places that people are smoking cigarettes and cigars.
Absolutely. My gosh. So
that would probably be most proud of, that nobody realizes that I had anything to do with it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's quite an accomplishment. Well, before we close the interview, is there anything else that you'd like to talk about?
I can't think of anything. If you think of something, call me back.
Okay. Well, Marty, thank you so much for being so very generous with your time and with your memories. We really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
It was good to get it off my chest.